Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll take a deep dive into the nation's first undergraduate degree program in psychedelics, offered next fall right here in San Francisco. We'll also learn about a new exhibit celebrating the music of vaudeville star Burt Williams. But first, my co-host Ethan Elkind sat down with East Bay, California State Assembly member Buffy Wicks on Friday to talk about California's housing crisis and what she's doing in Sacramento to fix it. Here it is.
Tonight, we're joined by Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, who represents California's 14th district, which includes a big part of the East Bay, from Hercules and Richmond down to Berkeley and Piedmont. A former Obama administration official, Buffy has become a force in Sacramento on issues like housing, paid family leave, and most recently, CEQA reform, California Environmental Quality Act. She's known for her fearless approach to tough debates. So, Buffy, thanks so much for being with us here on State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me. It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well. So last month, you brought forward a legislative package of 22 different bills, all aimed at fixing California's housing crisis by reducing red tape and some other reforms. And I'm wondering, how is that legislative package being received?
So far, so good, you know, but we're still in the first house. And as anyone who follows Sacramento knows, that the house-on-house dynamic is always an interesting one on both sides. So we expect bills to change as they go through the process. But so far, we've had really good luck getting them out of Housing Committee and Local Gov and some of the other committees that they've gone through. Many of them are now sitting in my committee, Appropriations Committee, where I feel good about moving those bills out of my own committee here in the coming weeks and then getting them onto the floor. But I do think the politics of this issue has changed dramatically since I first got elected in 2018. And I think we're seeing that reflected in the fact that there's, I think, a bigger embrace for the need for a recognition that we have to streamline to make it easier to build housing in California.
So you think maybe there's been a bit of a wake-up call from the last election, or is it just that the crisis has gotten so bad with housing that there's now more movement towards solutions?
I think both. You know, I got elected in 2018, and I ran as a pretty pro-housing candidate in what has historically been a community that hasn't always supported that, right? I represent Berkeley and Oakland, other areas. You know, single-family zoning came from Berkeley, as many folks know. But I will say there's been so much work done at the grassroots level from YIMBY organizations and others, younger folks, people who don't want to leave California. They want to stay here. And so they're starting to show up in city council meetings and make demands more of local electeds and state electeds like myself that we have to make it easier to build. And I think it's in part because the crisis has metastasized to such a point that we have to do it. I also think when you see 200,000 folks experiencing homelessness and the numbers are growing every day, as an elected official, you have to kind of say, what's going on? Why can't we fix this problem? And I do think voters are upset. And obviously, California is a strongly Democratic state. But even within that, our Oakland mayor got recalled. The San Francisco mayor lost her reelection. Trump actually did better in Alameda County than I would have ever expected, scarily. And I think part of that is voters want the basic stuff done right. They want streets safe. They want a roof over their head. They want housing security. They want a good paying job. They want good schools, like the basic stuff. And on the housing front in particular, we have to have a real honest conversation with ourselves around delivering that and where we've faltered on that.
And on housing, of course, there are some people who are just opposed to more housing. But then there are people who want to see housing, but only if it's subsidized, affordable. There's a lot of antipathy, and I've noticed this even among many legislators, that they're really only in favor of subsidized, affordable housing. So what is your response when you hear that kind of an argument?
I'll be honest, I think it's a bit of a cop-out. I would love to solve our housing crisis with 100% affordable subsidized housing. That is not a budget reality in California, period. We are never going to be able to subsidize our way out of this problem. And I say this as someone who's carrying a $10 billion housing bond this year. I carried it last cycle too. I've been fighting for more money for affordable housing since I got into the legislature. I will keep doing that because I think we absolutely have to invest public resources in subsidized housing. But it's not going to be the way we solve this crisis for the long term or even the short term. And so that means we have to have missing middle, market rate. And a lot of folks, they make too much money to qualify for subsidized housing, but not enough to afford current market rate. And so the missing middle is another important piece of how we solve the crisis, which means private market rate housing. with a reasonable inclusionary amount, right? Deed restricted amount within those bigger projects that can bring in more lower income folks that need it into those places, but not too much of an inclusionary that makes it not feasible. And that's always the balance we're trying to strike from a policy point of view. And so I'm a all of the above housing person. I think we need all of it. Particularly, we have to make it easier to build in our infill where we have a current footprint. I also view this as a climate policy, an important climate policy. I think our climate policy is in part driven largely by our housing and transportation policy. And those things are all very connected. But I do think when you say I'm 100% supporting, 100% affordable, but I don't want to support the market rate, it's basically saying I'm not going to vote on reality.
Just want to let listeners know, we're speaking with Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, represents California's 14th district, centered in the East Bay, and talking about infill development and some of the obstacles. You're also carrying a bill, AB 609, which would be a pretty major reform to the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, which is California's law to have review of discretionary projects and mitigation where feasible. This has been a tough sort of third rail issue in California because you have labor unions and environmental groups very strongly in support of CEQA, and a lot of people on the housing side complaining about the impact of CEQA lawsuits on new projects. So how are you balancing the need for environmental protections with the need to try to streamline housing approvals?
Yeah, well, CEQA is, I think, a really important foundational law in California. And it's in large part why we have the clean air that we have and the open spaces that we have and a real commitment to ensuring that we keep those strong environmental protections and the lifestyle that I think many of us agree with from a values point of view. It's also a pretty blunt force instrument, right? And so it treats a transit-oriented housing development for nurses and teachers the same way it treats fracking, right? And oil drills. And those are two very different things for the environment. And so what I'm attempting to do here, and it's not without a political sort of warfare and politically fraught, but I think an important conversation for us to bring forth on a third rail issue in California, is to try to differentiate from that and to say, actually, housing that is on our current footprint, infill housing, is the most environmentally friendly housing that we should be building. And we should be incentivizing and making it as easy as possible to build that kind of housing. We know we're missing 2.5 million homes in the state. We know what the effects of that are, right? How can we create better policies to make sure we're actually incentivizing that? Housing is not bad. Housing is not toxic, right? It is a roof over people's heads, which is what we need. And so my bill essentially says, if you're infill housing, you get a CEQA exemption. You're going to be exempt from CEQA because that's where we should be building. Now, we're going to ensure that there's no building on the Cortese list of environmentally risky lands. There needs to be remediation components if there is building on former oil areas. We have to be very mindful of any sort of industrial lands, et cetera, right? But if it is zoned for housing, then we should make it easy to build that housing. So that's essentially the bill. We've also added, at the request of the environmental justice community, if you're building within a certain distance from freeways, et cetera, to have air filtration systems and other things as part as a requirement, all of that makes sense to me. We're happy to support that. I've done that in previous bills as well. But it's a tough conversation with friends. It's a tough conversation with the environmental justice community. It's a tough conversation with the building trades who are opposing the bill. And I come out of the labor movement. And again, a lot of my friends in labor, they use CEQA to leverage for their labor negotiations. But CEQA is not labor law. It's an environmental law, right? And so we've had some tough conversations. We'll keep doing it. But I just don't think CEQA in its current form is prepared for the year 2025 in California. And it needs to better suit our needs as a state.
And you just talked about the environmental benefits of infill and the climate connection as well. Can you expand on that a bit? Why do you see housing as a climate solution?
Yeah, because we're going to have to build somewhere. So the question fundamentally is, do we want to build out in our open spaces as far as the eye can see, building off into Nevada and beyond, right? Like heading east and track home after track home. Or do we want to build infill, right? When we have that expansive greenfield development, that means cars are on the road. I have teachers in Oakland Unified School District where my kids go to school who were born and raised in Oakland. They want to teach in Oakland. They can't afford to live here anymore. And so the realtors say drive till you qualify. So they're in their car, 4-hour round trip, living in Tracy, Stockton, and beyond to be able to teach here. So what's that doing to our environment when 71% of our greenhouse gas comes out of our exhaust pipes? But if you can build infill on transit transit lines, taking advantage of that, investments in public transportation, infill development. It means less vehicle miles traveled, less VMT, which is what we all want. There's also economic benefits when you have that sort of density serving our communities. And I live right off of College Avenue in Oakland. We see small business after small business struggling. But what if we're to put more density around College Avenue, around the BART stops in those areas, make it as easy as possible to build in those areas? That's what we're talking about. And then obviously they call gentle density, more ADUs, more lot splits. I support all of these things, but I really do view it as an important climate policy.
Well, let's talk about federal policy and how the state is positioning itself. So we've seen Trump's attacks on all sorts of environmental protections and going after states that are trying to go after polluters. So how do you see California positioning itself to defend its environmental standards on climate, air, and water? And where are the areas of vulnerabilities that you're worried about?
Yeah, we will fight as hard and as long as it takes, you know, and you have a very committed governor, you have a very committed legislature, you have a very committed attorney general. There's dozens of lawsuits they brought against the Trump administration. We are proud of our environmental track record in California. We've set the national standard in many ways, and we will continue to do so under this current regime as well. My big concern, frankly, is the budget. We are a donor state. We send more money federally than we receive. And with the threats of what the Trump administration is doing, a significant amount of our budget is federal funds that come back to us. So we're very concerned about that. The budget's going to be really difficult this year in California. And so when I talk about the need for more money for affordable housing, we're leading the charge. The Assembly is very much leading the charge in the budget negotiations for more money for our multifamily housing fund program and all these other really important programs that fund housing shovel-ready projects that are ready to go if they could get the financing for our lowest income folks that need it desperately. It's like a direct resource that they need. That's made more difficult by the current budget. So those are my big concerns and things that I worry about at night. The budget reality is going to be really rough. And then obviously beyond the housing and environmental issues, there's obviously the impacts on our immigrant communities and so many others, LGBTQ communities. It's so far-reaching and it's so disheartening and it makes me angry what is happening to this country right now because of him. But we will fight every which way we can in California to protect our citizens, to support our communities, to keep our environment clean and keep fighting for the regulations that we believe in.
Well, I guess I'm not surprised that the budget would be top of mind, given, as you mentioned, you are chairing the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly. And I'm wondering, is that that changes your perspective on all these different initiatives, social programs as well, when you have to deal with the price tag of them? And is there something you wanted to communicate to the people to understand about the work of the Appropriations Committee?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're going to have to make very tough choices when you're talking about needed health care for low-income folks, when you're talking about resources for childcare, when you're talking about resources for housing. All of these things are so important and so critical. It also means that these programs have to be cost effective and have a strong ROI, and we have to run those programs well, which we should be doing in any budget environment, right? It's taxpayer money. So I think that that's really important. But it also goes back to bring it back to the beginning of our conversation, the need for more streamlining. When we make it cheaper to build housing because projects are not caught in years and years and years of bureaucratic delay, that saves us in the long run, right? That means housing is more affordable. That means we need less subsidized housing. So I really view it as we have to do the public investments coupled with the streamlining and making it easier. So I think all these things go together. I think we're in a big awakening in California around the housing questions here because of the crisis, because of the budget of where it is. And we have to get more clever and more creative, but we have to solve this problem because so many of our communities are relying on it.
So we're speaking again with Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, representing California's 14th district, which is most of the East Bay from Hercules and Richmond down to Berkeley and Piedmont. And Buffy, you famously held your then newborn daughter on the assembly floor while casting a vote, which is a moment I think that really symbolized the challenge of balancing public service and family life. How has being a parent shaped your view of the policies that we need to support families in California?
She's almost five, so time flies. You know, I think about them every day when I do the work I do. I know that sounds a little cliched as a politician, but I genuinely worry about the world we're leaving for them and the California that we're leaving for them. I want them to be able to get into UC Berkeley someday, right? Or the best school. I think Berkeley's the best public institution in California. I'm biased. I represent it. But be able to have those opportunities. I want them to be able to buy a home one day. I want them to be able to raise a family here on a middle class income. And right now that is not a possibility for thousands and thousands of families in California. And so for me, like when I walk away from this experience, I'm in my fourth of six terms, if I have the honor of being able to go all the way. And I think about, what do I want to have changed? I want to have changed structurally how we fix our housing crisis here. So for them and that generation, they have the ability to live here and to not be so financially burdened by the overbearing costs of housing here. So I think about it all the time, and it really informs the work I do and just the struggle of being a working parent. I mean, it is hard. I am juggling, my husband's juggling, we're juggling, and we're privileged. We're a dual income household with two decently paying jobs. If you're a single parent with three jobs, trying to do all the things, it is so difficult out there. And so my heart really goes out to folks that are struggling, and I know that they are. And, you know, I think about that every day on every vote I take, on the bills that I pursue. I support all the social safety net stuff. I also do work in food insecurity because we have a major food insecurity issue here. Always fighting for more resources for childcare. It's more expensive to send my kid to preschool than to UC Berkeley. You know, it's just, it's crazy, right? So those are the things that I care a lot about, but they really inform a lot of my thinking and they keep me humble, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're right in the thick of it with a five-year-old. So you mentioned housing being one of the top priorities that you're working on. So if you could get any bill passed, no amendments, wave a magic wand kind of thing, what would be the solution you'd want to see California implement?
Someday I do want to write a bill that goes through with no amendments. I've yet to do that. But for sure, my top priority bill right now is AB 609, which is my CEQA infill exemption for infill housing. That is the broad structural change on housing that I'm looking for that I think is also surgical change for CEQA, right? Again, I want to protect the core tenets of CEQA because I do think it's important, but ensure that it doesn't get weaponized to stop housing. So to me, that is by far my top priority bill. If I'm able to get that done and onto the governor's desk this year, I think it's probably going to be one of the landmark bills of my career, and hopefully has the impact that we're all hoping for.
All right. Well, I'm going to wish you good luck with that. I got one more question for you. I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but we have a governor's race coming up next year. Now, this current governor campaigned on 3.5 million new housing units.
Yep.
Came up well short. Haven't seen a lot of leadership there. Is there something you're hoping is, you know, an issue that really rises to prominence? Or is there an issue that you're looking for in terms of who you would support for governor in California?
Well, I still think it's housing. And I also want to actually give the governor accolades. I don't think any of us anticipated COVID when we all took these roles. And I've had many conversations with him about this. He and I are very in sync on our approach of what we need to do. He's also operating with a legislature, you know. Having said that, I think housing is going to remain a top issue till we fix it. Because when it's the number one driving cost for every family in California, until we figure that out, we have a major affordability crisis when it comes to housing. And so I think that's going to be one of the top issues yet again until we fix it. And hopefully we can fix it and go on to fixing other problems.
All right. Well, good luck to you with this legislative session. And Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, just want to thank you for sharing your insights and perspective on what's happening in California and sharing it with our listeners here on State of the Bay.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ethan. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk about the nation's first undergraduate program in psychedelics, only in San Francisco. Join our conversation. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
Each week, BayMade features one local independent podcast or producer. This week, we're sharing episodes from California Sun. Host Jeff Scheckman looks at the appalling conditions of farmworker housing, the latest from the ever-changing Tenderloin, San Francisco's toxic nuclear legacy, and the local impact of Trump's tariffs. Tune into BayMade Monday through Thursday at 11:30 a.m. right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, Bay Area.
Hi, I'm San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent, Dr. Maria Su. Please join me at a KALW Town Hall conversation Tuesday, May 6. I want to hear and answer your questions about public education. You can send them to feedback at kalw.org. You can find free tickets at kalw.org/events. I look forward to our conversation.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. With depression and anxiety on the rise, psychedelics are reemerging as tools for healing, and higher education is taking notice. Tonight, Anne Huffman, Chair of Undergraduate Studies at the California Institute for Integral Studies, joins us to talk about the nation's first undergraduate program in psychedelics. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you for having me, Grace. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah. And listeners, we want you to be part of this next conversation. Have psychedelics helped your mental health? Call us to tell us about it. You can call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can find us on our social media channels or email us with your story at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Anne, tell us, what inspired the California Institute for Integral Studies to launch this program, this first undergraduate degree in psychedelics?
I think it was really that we saw a need and identified that gap. And then, you know, also as well, anecdotally, understanding where we're poised in the nation around psychedelic therapies, treatments, and what the federal government will allow, what the California state government will allow. And one of the real issues we noticed is that there's a real barrier to access to graduate programs or certificates if you don't have an undergraduate degree. And we have two successful undergraduate bachelor degree completion programs. So it made a lot of sense to us to create something that speaks to a wide range of people from very diverse backgrounds who are interested in psychedelic studies, participating in the field in, you know, so many critical and amazing ways, but can't access higher education or jobs because they don't have an undergraduate bachelor's degree. Mm.
And for people who aren't familiar with your institution, can you tell us a little bit about CIIS?
Well, CIIS is really founded on the principles of integral and whole person education. So, you know, we have a strong interest in East-West psychology and, you know, things like that, as well as training therapists. So we have an incredibly strong clinical training program for clinical psychologists, as well as counseling therapists and things like that. So it really, for us in the undergraduate program, made a lot of sense because there are so many pathways and avenues at CIIS for our undergraduate graduates, as well as globally where they could go.
Hmm. So when we're talking about the curriculum for this undergraduate degree, what kind of classes might I be taking in order to fulfill my requirements?
We have an abundance of classes and richness. For example, in your first semester, you'd be taking a psychology and psychedelics class. You'd be doing neuroscience of psychedelics. And as well, we'd have the global indigenous knowledges and eco-psychedelics class. And then in your second semester, we'd move you into psychopharmacology of psychedelics. You'd have ethical and legal considerations. And then we really, since this is a Bachelor of Science degree, we have a strong research track. So you'd be taking your research methods in your second semester, which would lead into your senior capstone project in your third semester, as well as taking psychedelic advocacy, equity, research, and global connection, and an expanding consciousness class around psychedelics and transformation.
It sounds pretty complete. And this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking to Anne Huffman. She's the chair of the undergraduate studies at the California Institute for Integral Studies, or CIIS. It's going to be hosting the first undergraduate program where you can get a degree in psychedelics. And we'd love to hear from you, listeners. Do you think that studying psychedelics at a university legitimizes their use or opens the door to misuse? And what role do you think psychedelics should play in mental health treatment? And should universities be leading that conversation? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And if you've had an experience in which you've used psychedelics to help you with a mental illness or mental health issues, definitely give us a call. And I wanted to ask you, so we talked a little bit about the curriculum that a student might participate in. Will the students work directly with psychedelics in that program, or is that reserved for clinical contexts, or not? Will they not be using them at all?
They won't be using them at all. In fact, we'll be asked, all of our students will be integrity agreements that they won't be using psychedelics in an illicit way, you know, based on the laws of their home state and things like that. Because, you know, we really are giving a broad foundation from an academic perspective. We are not training clinicians. We are not training facilitators. We are, you know, inviting a diverse population in to take this back out to where they want to work with or the people they want to support, whether we're a springboard for somebody who wants to work in psychedelic tourism, run a psilocybin clinic, go on to become a therapist, become a researcher, you know, or work to decriminalize and destigmatize the use of psychedelics. That's really what we're aiming for. We're aware that folks are always going to be using substances, but we're going to be very mindful and have oversight with our students about, you know, our container for the work we do in academia and in this setting.
We have a listener, Philip, who writes, I have long COVID. Microdosing psilocybin has been one of the most helpful treatments in both coping with the illness and reducing my symptoms. What's the future of psychedelic therapy in treating chronic illnesses like long COVID, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, etc.? And are there any studies underway that you know of? Anne, what do you think?
I think it has fantastic potential, and I think it's really important that we train people to have critical thinking skills, to have research skills, to continue to carry this work forward. You know, we're at an interesting intersection here, right, with the current climate in the government shutting down all research. They're shutting down cancer research. So what does that mean for therapeutic modalities with psychedelics? And we know what the FDA has currently approved. Is that going to change or not change? But my hope is that we continue to push forward and really investigate and support, you know, research and treatments that help people. And I think overall, that's an outstanding goal for not just our undergraduate program, but, you know, globally, right? How do we continue to help people in ways that hasn't been possible for all of us before?
Well, they're getting so, psychedelics generally are getting so much more play in terms of our mental health. And, you know, certainly I've read how veterans can be using it to treat symptoms like PTSD or illnesses like PTSD. There are lots of different kinds of psychedelics, but generally, Anne, can you explain how they factor in helping us achieve better mental health? Like, what's the formulation or what's the way in which they work on our brains?
You know, in some ways, you know, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I'm going to have the best answer for that because that's sort of the ongoing research question. But I think a lot of it is that because a lot of it, like with psilocybin, is plant-based, it's that kind of organic medicine and therapeutic work done in conjunction with existing current therapeutic treatments such as talk therapy. In a way, it kind of allows people to bypass, right, some internal structures or pain pathways, if you will, and allows people to access a place of well-being and bring that back to themselves in a healing way.
If you're an individual who's seeking to use psychedelics as part of their mental health strategy, would going to somebody with a degree like the one that you're offering at CIIS be helpful in distinguishing who might be a legitimate practitioner or somebody who could really help you versus, you know, somebody who's not well versed in how this might be used?
Yeah, great question. I think so. I think always, you know, consumers, I would hope, would want to have access to the best information to best help themselves. So best practices, most current research, most insight and understanding where to access treatments, you know, at clinics and things like that, where they can be safely guided through the process with support in a meaningful way that does, provide transformative healing for them.
Well, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan, and I'm in conversation with Anne Huffman. She's the chair of the Undergraduate Studies Program at the California Institute for Integral Studies, and they are introducing a new undergraduate degree in psychedelics. And what role do you think, listeners, should psychedelics play in mental health treatment? Have you ever used psychedelics to help you overcome a mental health issue? You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Listener Rosanna writes, will these courses be made available for those of us not pursuing a bachelor's degree but seeking to enhance our knowledge of psychedelics? If so, where can we find details?
And that's a great question. And actually, currently, we have the Center for Psychedelic Treatments and Research that's run by a dear colleague of mine, Dr. Janice Phelps at CIIS. It's a certificate program. And this is where not just licensed individuals can earn a certificate. They are now opening up the program to those with an undergraduate degree or a master's degree to participate in training around using psychedelics safely in clinical settings and to do cutting edge research. And that can all be found on our CIIS website. So if you are into Google Foo, then look up CIIS and the CPTR.
Well, we've referred a little bit to the legal status of psychedelics in this country. I mean, Oregon has pioneered the legal use of psilocybin in supervised settings, and California's efforts at statewide decriminalization have so far stalled. I mean, psychedelic-assisted therapy is still illegal under federal law. How are you helping your students, or will you be helping your students, navigate this patchwork of regulation to really understand, you know, I mean, it's one thing to study the issues around it, but to actually, you know, learn how to use it, it seems kind of difficult in this environment.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, you know, you're pinpointing something we really talked about when we were creating this degree is how do we create advocates? How do we create people who want to advocate for the decriminalization, the destigmatization? How do we help equip people with the tools to make changes to the law in their home state or their state county or where they live, right? How do we give people the knowledge, help them understand ways in which they can empower themselves to make the changes they want to see?
I mean, this is a little bit off center, but I mean, do you think that the word itself, psychedelics, kind of puts people off a little bit because it has a lot of baggage and it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people?
You know, in some ways, I think it does. I was talking to my 91-year-old mother the other day, and she had this look of horror on her face that I was talking about these things. And, you know, but we had a really great conversation that was really rich. And by the end of it, she had shifted her thinking because I unpacked the perspective of understanding, you know, the scare tactics from back in the day of evil psychedelics and bad trips isn't what we're talking about in this current, you know, era, right? And that generationally speaking, more and more younger people are accessing, you know, the therapeutic aspects of plant medicines, psychedelics, ketamine, entheogens. And so I think it's critically important that we speak to this and change the landscape and vocabulary.
And what was it when you were talking to your 91-year-old mom that got her to shift to see your point of view? Was there any particular fact, or was it just the way you, the presentation as a whole?
I'd like to think it's because I'm her daughter, but
well, that too, and that's obvious.
But I think it was really talking about the treatment of PTSD D with veterans and first responders and other populations who've suffered trauma, those who have treatment-resistant depression or chronic depression, those, you know, a lot of students coming into our cohort that's starting this fall are talking about working around life transitions, particularly death and dying. And so, you know, as well as folks who are, you know, dealing with cancer or those who are, you know, we had our person who called in or wrote in about long haul COVID, right? There are so many areas where people are hungry to have help and heal themselves and move into a state of well-being. And being able to frame that and give my mother that context really helped her understand that there's a much wider application than being, you know, I'll be old school here, being a hippie and getting high.
Well, when you think about using psychedelics, and I'm going to rely on you, Anne Huffman, to rebrand that word, but as part of your program. But when we think about using that, is that always going to be in your mind in conjunction with something like talk therapy, whether that's an individual therapist or a group or whatnot? Or do you envision a world in which psychedelics will be administered and that's all you're going to need?
I think it's a both and, right? Mm. Because some people are really going to need the therapeutic talk therapy or some sort of, you know, psychological and mental health support in that way, as well as being in a safe space and setting to use the psychedelics to also support them in their journey. But it may not necessarily be a one size fits all. And currently, right now, we're being really conservative in places like Oregon and Colorado that it's, you know, there, it needs to be a therapeutic setting. It needs to have facilitators and people who have been trained in the use so that, you know, if there is an experience, that there's a way to synthesize, process, and integrate it for the person using the substance.
Well, we were talking a little bit about the kind of complications that come because psychedelics are something that come with baggage, but there's also kind of a little bit of a complicated cultural history when you think about indigenous knowledge and colonialism and cultural appropriation when it comes to these, some of these psychedelics. And I wondered, is your program addressing that aspect of using psychedelics how that might be integrated within the work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, the number one problem is cultural appropriation and psychedelic tourism, right? That folks are traveling to places like South America because they want to experience a shamanic journey or, you know, do an ayahuasca ceremony without really understanding the tradition, the culture, and the sacredness. So how, again, do we help people understand the longstanding traditions, you know, and do this in an ethical and responsible way, that these aren't necessarily something that was made in the pharmaceutical lab, right? Mm-hmm. That you pop down to the pharmacy and buy, but that there is actually, has been centuries long containers and practices for the use of these substances.
Mm-hmm. This is not just go down to Walgreens, get a statin, and then you're done, right?
Yeah, you know, grow a few mushrooms and, you know, it's, and I think this is where the challenge is differentiating from, you know, how marijuana has been used, and that's a much more recreational piece in some ways. And so there's one perspective on that type of use, which doesn't have the same longstanding ceremonial and ritual use in the ways that some of the other, you know, plant medicines themselves have.
Right. I mean, things are different. As our producer, Ann Harper, says, it's not your parents' trip that we're talking about. So, and probably in a good way. As this idea becomes, I mean, I think this, having an undergraduate degree to study the use of psychedelics is almost a first step in kind of legitimizing it for a bigger or wider population. Do you find that groups like the organizations that run the American Psychiatric Association and the like, are they embracing the idea of psychedelics within the practice of treating mental health, or is there still a kind of an arm's length distance, like, no thanks?
You know, I think, you know, bodies like that tend to move more slowly than the embrace of culture and younger generations, right? That there's a due process that they need to go through, they need to study, they need to reflect. And I think in some ways, you know, we are in a culture that is moving incredibly quickly because there are so many different changes, so many different things and arenas, and such a diverse population of people interested in psychedelics and those kind of things in a way that psychiatric treatments and institutions are just cannot be as agile and as responsive in adapting because of their own processes.
In our last few minutes, I'm curious, Anne, if this degree is the first of its kind, where do you think this field will be in 10 years? What do you hope your students will help create?
Honestly, you know what? I hope they go forward and create really new and amazing things. I hope they create their own degree programs or create their own training programs specific to the populations and the people they want to help, they want to support, or the work they want to do. I would love to see advocacy and support for marginalized populations and, you know, again, the destigmatization and decriminalization. But I would also love to see, you know, therapeutic work with psychedelics as part of cancer treatment in a hospital. And that's something that the insurance industry approves of, you know, and that this just becomes part of our landscape of whole person health.
Well, Anne, if people want to learn more about the CIIS program, where can they go?
They can hop on the website and our CIIS website. They'll find information about our undergraduate programs. They'll find information about the Center for Psychedelic Therapies and Research. The website is ciis.edu. And we're more than happy to respond to all the inquiries. And I will say that we've already filled one cohort for this September, and we are now in the process of enrolling a second cohort. So we are eager to talk to you if you're interested in our program.
Well, Anne Huffman, thanks so much for joining us tonight on State of the Bay and telling us about the future of psychedelics.
Thank you so much, Grace.
That was Anne Huffman. She's the chair of undergraduate studies at the California Institute for Integral Studies. Her work reminds us that healing and education can sometimes come from unexpected and ancient sources. Coming up after the break, we'll hear about a new exhibit celebrating the music of vaudeville star Burt Williams. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear how co-parenting sometimes comes with unique challenges.
The email said something like, "Hey, Aaliyah, thank you so much for Sky's hair. I know this was a lot to do, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, Yasmin."
The many ways we mother. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your vibe curator and selector. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
San Francisco is the home to many great museums: the De Young, the Exploratorium, and the Academy of Sciences. But did you know
We also have a Museum of Performance and Design. Started in 1947, the museum is dedicated to documenting and preserving the Bay Area's performing arts heritage. And it's this museum that is the home of the new exhibit on San Francisco's very own singer, songwriter, and vaudevillian star, Burt Williams. Here to tell us about Williams and the museum is the exhibit's curator, Gina Barnes. Gina, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. To start off, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Museum of Performance and Design?
Yes, it was founded in 1947 by Russell Hartley, who was a dancer and designer with the San Francisco Ballet. It actually began in his home, but as the collection grew larger and larger, it moved into its own dedicated space. So we collect materials that have to do with the performing arts, anything to do with the San Francisco Ballet, but the wider Bay Area community in general. We have everything from photographs to audio and sound recordings to programs, sheet music. And we have a small but mighty research room for people that want to come in person and do physical research. And we are located in the Bayview at 2200 Gerald Avenue, and it is free to visit.
And you recently opened an exhibit on Burt Williams. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Burt Williams and this story?
Yes. So Burt Williams was born in Nassau in the Bahamas in 1874. But as a very young child, he emigrated to America with his family, specifically to California. And for this exhibit, we wanted to focus on the music of Burt Williams. The Museum of Performance and Design has a pretty large collection of original sheet music from Burt Williams' time with the Williams and Walker Company, and also when he became a solo artist in his later years. So as you mentioned, he actually got his start in San Francisco, where he met his partner, George Walker. They met, I believe, on Mission Street, and they started performing in minstrel acts, in traveling acts around the country. So they became very successful recording artists. They were some of the first Black performers to actually record their music with the Victor Talking Machine Company. And later on, Burt Williams actually was one of the first Black artists to record and become incredibly popular with Columbia Records. At the time, I've read some stats that his songs were selling records around like 150 to 200,000 copies, which was incredible. Wow. For that time. Mm-hmm. It would be considered really successful if you sold maybe 10, 20,000 copies. So he was an incredibly famous performer.
What was a typical show like?
So I would say Burt Williams started as, he started in the 1890s doing what were minstrel performances. Then he moved into Black musical theater, and his later career was what I would call vaudeville and Broadway main revues. But at the time, in the 1890s, when he and George Walker were first starting out, they really were not able to perform beyond what we would consider to be quite stereotypical and demeaning minstrel performances. So, for example, one of the very classic characters in minstrel performances at the time was the Jim Crow character.
So now, blackface.
Yes, he performed with burnt cork, with blackface. It almost seemed from the biographies of him that I've read that he felt this pull between what the expectations of mainly white audiences were, which was to perform these very stereotypical, demeaning caricatures, versus Black audiences who really wanted representation and a way to uplift their racial class as a whole. And so he really tried to thread that needle. I mean, there was, even at the time, there were a lot of Black critics who were very understandably critical of his use of blackface. He really tried to elevate the characters and flesh them out so they weren't just these two-dimensional stereotypical depictions. Right. And so he really tried to take it from this kind of dim-witted, just flat, two-dimensional character into something that was more fleshed out and had an actual personality, and was more about a downtrodden everyman that all people could relate to.
Okay. You mentioned Nobody. I think we actually have a clip of that song. Why don't we give it a listen?
I am filled with lots of pain, who soothes my problems of sin dread. Nobody. When winter comes with snow and sleet, and me with hunger and cold feet, who says you're stupid, go and eat. Nobody.
So yeah, Nobody was extremely popular at the time. It was first performed in 1906 in the Broadway musical Abyssinia, and it became an instant classic among all audiences because it had this ability to kind of blend Williams' wit and humor with heartbreak, and it incorporated subtle satire that Williams was really known for. And it also highlighted emotional and social struggles that Black audiences could absolutely relate to, but also white audiences. It became a really universal song.
Hmm. Can you give us some examples of Burt's humor in the songs especially?
Yes. I personally love the song Save a Little Dram for Me. This was written and performed at first during Prohibition. He's performing in the persona of a preacher, but the preacher is actually preaching to his churchgoers about how he wants them to save a little dram of moonshine for him. You know, why are you drinking and not including me? it's just an excellent example of his type of his wit and his humor.
Well, with that kind of an introduction, let's listen to a sample of the song.
Brother, if you want more riches, save a little dram for me. Glory, hallelujah, drinking gin ain't against my teaching. Treat me with equality.
Prohibition. Get your drink the best way you can. right, Gina, tell us about the Frogs.
Yes, so the Frogs was actually formed by George Walker, Williams' partner, in 1908. And it was formed as a society to support and uplift members of the Black performing arts community in the early 20th century. These were people that were mostly working in vaudeville in musical theater. They had been inspired by the American Actors Beneficial Association, which was sort of a union. It was a group that didn't allow Black performers into their ranks. Things were still incredibly segregated at this time. Mm-hmm. This was their answer to that kind of beneficial group that would allow Black professionals to advance in the theater world and try to help each other despite the incredible amounts of bigotry and discrimination that still existed.
Clearly, Burt Williams had an incredible influence on the entertainment industry, especially as a Black man in that period. When he died in 1922, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great civil rights activist, offered the following obituary. When in the calm after day of thought and struggle to racial peace, we look back to pay tribute to those who helped the most, we shall single out for highest praise those who made the world laugh. Bob Cole, Ernest Hogan, George Walker, and above all, Burt Williams. For this was not mere laughing. This was the smile that hovered above blood and tragedy, the light mask of happiness that hid breaking hearts and bitter souls. This is the top of bravery, the finest thing in service. May the world long honor the undying fame of Burt Williams as a great comedian, a great Negro, and a great man. Gina, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to learn more, you can find the Burt Williams exhibit online at the Museum of Performance and Design or in person at 2200 Gerald Avenue in San Francisco.
The Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll be talking about racial profiling in the Bay Area housing market. For more information about tonight's show, visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so that you never miss an episode. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper and Jillian Emblad. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.